As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Right.
So it's not copyright infringement if we comment on it, by the way. I think those are the rules, right?
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe less than 30 seconds, so let's stop right about now.
Sure. All right. Let's just be safe. It's enjoyable to put this Yugoslavian breakup music on before every single episode. This one is called Zorane by Roki Volovic. We played one of his last songs, Panther, in our last episode. But what's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. Danny, how's it going, man? How are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. So, you know, it's kind of funny, guys. We recorded this podcast on Sunday. And we had such a great time recording this podcast on this exact subject. We decided to do it over again.
Yeah, that's the reason.
We decided just to record the entire thing over again. So, we'll just be up front. So on Sunday, right now we're recording this on Tuesday night. So we tried recording this episode on Sunday night, and we did the entire episode. It was about 2 hours long. And when we were finished, when I opened up the audio files to, you know, get ready to post everything the following day, my audio was messed up. It was all screwed up. It did not pass the seal of approval, the quality that we need to release the show. So we're just like, all right, well, we can't actually release this to the public. It is unintelligible. At least my audio was.
Yeah, that was the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it was unintelligible.
You know what's so funny about that, Henry, is that, you know, as some people might already know, I've just recently moved to Puerto Rico, and I feel like we were both, myself especially, very trepidatious about how do we, you know, do this podcast, because right now I'm super nomadic. I'm like recording in an Airbnb. There's no desk, so I've got like a monitor and a, you know, Mac Mini plugged in, and I'm like on a dresser. And I'm like contending with background noise and so many things. So we were super worried that my file was going to do us in. But lo and behold, nothing changed on your side, and yours is the one that crapped out.
Well, you know, the reason why the audio is messed up is because someone convinced me to get this microphone that has a button that makes the sound shitty.
No, dude. That wasn't
so there's
the button.
A button on this mic on this fucking microphone that makes the sound shitty. And why would you add a button like that to a microphone?
You gotta, dude. First of all, you gotta be on penis mode. You gotta be on penis mode. There's a button on there that looks like a dickhead. That's the one you gotta be on. And all the other ones do different things. The one that makes it sound shitty is the one that's omnidirectional.
Why do they have that?
Because it's not shitty. It's just a different
omnidirectional.
So that you could put a microphone in the middle of a room and people all around it can be picked up by the microphone. That's why. That's not the podcast setting. The dickhead setting is the podcast setting. That's the cardioid. That's the one you got to use. Anyway, it wasn't the button, dude. It was like your audio kept doubling
over. I just want a simple fucking microphone that has one button that makes it sound good when I talk.
You sound like some of the people I work with. It has nothing to do with that. There was something totally different happening. You were like MC, you know, remixing your lyrics, like stuttering, you know, like so much more. It was unintelligible. Had nothing to do with that. just gonna put that out there.
Well, whatever I can do to not blame myself. I guess I don't know. If freak things happen in this business, you know, it's been a while since something like that has happened where we went through an entire episode and had to re-record it, at least since I've moved into my new place. I think last time it happened in our, we did a World War One propaganda episode, and the background music, the background noise with traffic was so bad. I had like a temper tantrum and I was like, fuck it, I'm not doing this podcast anymore. Podcasting's stupid. Whoever podcasts is an idiot anyway. So that we came back though. All right. So what we were talking about last week is that we were doing our follow-up episode on the fall of Yugoslavia and the wars that erupted in the Balkans afterwards. So last week we did a very high-level episode, I would say, a high-level episode of Yugoslavia, the history there, the history in the Balkans, you know, the rise of Yugoslavia, the eventual downfall of Yugoslavia, and then we got to the more so the beginning stages of the war, not necessarily going into that in great detail. However, we also, you know, talked about the current crisis right now with you know, the Republic of Srpska and, you know, the potential secession movement that's going on right now and the Serbian entity in Bosnia. So we're going to do a series, and, you know, we're going to do, you know, today's going to be about the Bosnian War, and then I think after this we're going to do an episode on Kosovo. But today we're going to focus primarily on Bosnia. And what makes the wars in the former Yugoslavia states in the 1990s so interesting, specifically in the case of Bosnia, it's the first European war to break out since World War II. But it also creates this debate over post-Cold War foreign policy. So this debate that happens, it's probably even more contested and emotional than a debate over the Persian Gulf War. And to pull this back, and just like, so you know what I mean, you know, during Iraq War One, Republicans were the interventionist, and then Democrats were mostly against the war. You know, the debate was pretty much on partisan lines. You know, Joe Biden is a good example on this. Joe Biden opposed the first Iraq War. No, he, you know, he was a champion of the second Iraq War, but, you know, he opposed the first Iraq War. He actually later said he was wrong for opposing it, but at that time, Joe Biden was dovish, and Biden kind of flips around in his foreign policy stance throughout his entire career, but, you know, this, you know, he kind of went with the party on this one. He went on the anti-Bush senior measure. Well, in the war in Bosnia, that flips on his head, so the liberal Democrats were the primary pushers of that intervention. So essentially, yesterday's peaceniks, they became the new warmongers. And if you look at archives of the New York Times, there's going to be a bunch of articles saying, we need to act right now. You know, you have you know, people who work for George Sr. who are resigning because he's not doing enough to stand up for the Muslim Bosniaks that are being massacred. You know, you have a million articles that are just highlighting the atrocities and, you know, the ethnic cleansing campaigns. You know, rape is a major element of these stories, and, you know, it is pretty bad. It was you know, a brutal conflict. Now these articles and, you know, the primary narrative from the corporate press and the U.S. government and NATO was that, you know, it was a conventional case of aggression by one state, Serbia, against another state, which was Bosnia. And, you know, the Serbs were, you know, these brutal monsters who were ethnically cleansing all the Muslims. So, you know, the way that the ethnic lines were kind of drawn is that the Bosniaks were kind of just, you know, the Muslims were considered, you know, more so of an ethnic group than just a, you know, a religion. So, you know, the Serbs, these brutal monsters, are ethnically cleansing. They're raping Muslim women. You know, they are engaged in, you know, systemic rape campaigns. There's these mass graves everywhere. There's really just nasty, nasty stuff going on. And now we have to act. And we have to act because the United States needs to preserve our credibility as the moral arbiters of the world. You know, how can we lead from behind? How can we sit here in the New World Order and let, you know, another Hitler developing Europe. And that's the narrative that's going on in the 1990s in the case of the war in Bosnia. And this leads to NATO intervening in February 1994 with the U.S. in the lead. And what makes this NATO intervention very significant even to this day is that it transforms NATO from purely a defensive alliance to an offensive alliance. Because in the case of Bosnia, NATO projected military power against a secessionist government that hadn't actually attacked a member of the NATO alliance. You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
So there's no actual aggression. It's not like the Serbs went ahead and attacked a NATO member. It was just, you know, it was an internal civil conflict. So NATO projects power in a civil war, essentially, which is not the purpose of NATO. Now, you know, if you listen to our last episode, we claim that the Bosnian War was ultimately caused by identity politics. So, you know, different ethnic groups of the former Yugoslavia, they feared being dominated by other ethnic groups. So, you know, the quick history is that, you know, Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, Macedonia, Serbia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina, you know, these countries were all republics within the former state of Yugoslavia. And, you know, this is a state that was ran by a strongman dictator, Tito, for years. You know, Tito was a partisan resistance leader during the Nazi occupation of the Balkans. During World War II, he led maybe the most successful resistance campaign against the Nazis during the war. And, you know, he rises to the dictator of Yugoslavia. And, you know, after Tito died in the year 1980, many of the safeguards that prevented different ethnic groups from fighting, you know, begin to dissipate. So there's a surge in ethnic ethnic nationalism, which comes adjacent to the decline of the civic state. And by the early 1990s, the state just implodes. So you have these different secession groups, you know, along ethnic lines, you know, they start to emerge among the different republics of Yugoslavia. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, the only states that wanted to keep their communist governments were Serbia and Montenegro. So Croatia, Slovenia, Macedonia, and Bosnia, they all wanted sovereignty.
Right.
So, you know, what this leads to is that Croatia and Slovenia, they declare their independence in 1991, which, you know, puts Bosnia in an interesting position, because they had to choose between independence or a possible second-class role in a Serb-dominated Yugoslavia with, at the time, you know, a pretty Serbian chauvinist president in Slobodan Milosevic. So Bosnia says, I want out too. They vote for their independence in March of 1992. And, you know, the secession of, you know, what ultimately happens is, like, the secession of Croatia and Slovenia from Yugoslavia. You know, they left the Bosnian Muslims there. You know, they left them in a greater, or members of a greater Serbia. And, you know, they ultimately feared and anticipated that they would be treated unfairly in a Yugoslavia dominated by the Serbs. The Serbians who were living in Bosnia, they had the same idea. So they feared being a minority in a Bosnian state that was dominated by Muslims. So now, these are administrative areas that have constantly had their borders redrawn by different empires and kingdoms and pluralities, like, you know, the Ottoman Empire, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, later the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. You know, this is a region that has always been dominated by regional players. Even now to this date, the region is dominated by NATO and basically the Western world. They've always had some type of, like, you know, kind of imperial overlord there. So, but, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that there's an overlap of who lives there, or who lives where, more importantly. So, you know, Bosnia, within its borders of, you know, the sovereign state, within the monopoly of violence of the state of Bosnia, I guess it doesn't really have a monopoly of violence because NATO is kind of runs it, but, you know, Bosnia just doesn't have Bosnian Muslims living there. Bosnia has three major ethnic groups. They have Serbs, they have Croats, and they have Bosniak Muslims. So Bosnian independence, it sparks an independence movement within the Bosnian borders of the Serbian minority. So the Serbians were fighting for their own national sovereignty. Does that all make sense? You following me? You think the listeners are following me right now?
Okay. Yeah, no, totally.
It's kind of like a dream. All right, you know, you ever see Inception?
Mm-hmm.
A dream within a dream?
Right.
A secession movement within a secession movement?
Right. I mean, it's a nested secession movement is what it is.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll get into some comparisons examples. Or some hypotheticals, sure. Some examples. But I guess it's important to note, you know, what Serbians are thinking. You know, Serbians have been a very historically victimized group. So, you know, they've always
certainly
been
doesn't,
under...
I mean, that doesn't obviously, you know, pretend that they don't do anything wrong either. And it doesn't justify any of their wrongdoings moving forward. But you're absolutely right that they are very
I'm just saying as part of the national consciousness, I think it's more important. Or the ethnic consciousness, or, you know, part of the identity is, you know, some type of victimization. So, you know, that's what will typically ignite a lot of ethnic nationalism. Like, you know, when your origin story has some type of humiliation, and, you know, you see it with Chinese nationalism right now, you know, they want to end this century of humiliation when they were carved up by, you know, different European countries for many decades, when, you know, all of their cities weren't under one strong Chinese state. They were basically international cities ran by the West. You know, there's that same mentality with the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. I mean, there's multiple humiliations in German history, like the humiliation of World War One and all the unfair war reparations and all of that. And then there is also within German history, there's the humiliation of the 30-year war, when, you know, Germans were basically used as pawns by other European powers, and it was a devastating war with, you know, millions and millions and millions of people who died. So, I mean, there's always this kind of humiliation aspect in, you know, these national origin stories. So the Serbian humiliation, you know, if you want to go back, is that, you know, they're basically being controlled by neighboring empires, or at the very least they're being used as pawns by neighboring empires. So you know, they were part of, you know, the Eastern Roman Empire and then the Ottoman Empire, and then they were always under threat of the Habsburgs and of Austria and Hungary. You know, the first great ethnic cleansing, because we're going to get into that, or, you know, it's a feature of the war, ethnic cleansing, is that, you know, the Balkans, it happened in the Balkans when the Ottomans invaded, and they, you know, invaded the ancient Serbian homeland of Kosovo, you know, during the watermark of Serbian civilization, when they had an empire and they controlled vast territories in the Balkan regions. You know, so you have this origin story of, we were once this great society, and then the Muslims, they came and they took it all away. And, the Ottomans, you know, separated young children from their parents, and they raised them up to be devout Muslims. And, you know, these were the Janissaries, and they were given special privileges, such as land annexed by the Turks. So, you know, these native Christians who were forcibly converted to Islam, you know, they make up the ruling class of, you know, of the Ottoman government in the Balkans. But they Serbia wins its independence from the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, but they had to deal with other regional powers. So the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who was constantly trying to absorb Serbia, or at the very least, you'd be a bulwark into some national sovereign movement. Now, probably the worst fear of the Serbians was, how they were treated during World War II, because there were simultaneous genocides going on in the Balkans in World War II. One against the Jews and one against the Serbians there. So the Croats and the Bosnia, they formed part of a Nazi Croatian Ustasha state.
Right. It was really brutal too.
Yeah, it was very brutal. So it's kind of in the DNA at some point. Now, according to the U.S. government, the war was caused by Serbian aggression. So Bosnia gained recognition as an independent state in early 1992. They held a referendum in March 1st, 1992, in which a majority voted to secede from Yugoslavia. Therefore, all the support which Serbia provided to the Bosnian Serbs constituted an illegal intervention in Bosnia's internal affairs. However, to make matters more confusing, is that the referendum, which was boycotted by the Serbs, was in itself a violation of Yugoslavia's constitution.
That's right.
The constitution, it conferred a right to secession, but there had to be a mutual agreement among the nations composing of Yugoslavia. And they set up this constitution like this for a reason. And the reason was to avoid majoritarianism. So in other words, the tyranny of the majority. So we can name other countries like this in the world that have a majoritarian type system where when a country is very divided by either a sectarian divide or an ethnic divide, and one group has power and the other group doesn't. And this is an example, a very clear modern day example would be Iraq post Iraq War II, where you have a majority Shia group. So Shias are about 70% of the population. They dominate the 30% Sunni population. And then you can also say the same thing about Saudi Arabia. You have a 60 to 70% Sunni population that dominates the Shia population. You could say the same thing about India, where you have a Hindu population that dominates the Muslim population. Right. There are many examples where the majority has places itself as the main power holders within a state. So also in Canada as well, Canada. No, I'm joking.
Where there's Canada, a majority.
Fucking Canada.
Also the United States, where there's a majority of white people and
in Canada. So a move to secession without the consent of the Serbs was a violation of constitution. Here's where the conundrum is, and I think this is where we can have an interesting conversation, because there's a lot of gray areas right here. So if an act of secession is illegal in a state, or if it violates its constitution's terms, how can that violate international law? Or why would that violate international law?
Mm-hmm. It's a fair question.
Or...
And I think...
Oh, go ahead.
No, continue. Finish your point.
Oh, I was just going to kind of, you know, follow that up with another question. You know, if you're a majority group and you're tied together by a language or a religion or, you know, or whatever, and, you know, you're confined to a geographic area or a province, and there's that will, do you have the right of self-determination?
I mean, I think probably now is a good time for us to bring up that hypothetical. I think this was around the time, the last time we ended up recording this.
Let me pull this back. One more. This is like the real, this is what I'm trying to get at. Is there a right to secession in international law? That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, let's explore that. So I brought up this this hypothetical last time, and I got a really genuine reaction out of you last time, because this is something that, you know, we didn't write down, and, you know, we didn't plan this at all, but it worked out so well, and I'm hoping that the same runs through this time around, because it just worked last time. So I was thinking a lot about this question about secession and the right of, you know, like sovereign rights, you know, within a nation state. And I kept coming to our favorite state, Texas, as an example. Now, Texans, they seem to hold the opinion that they have the right to secede. And I'm not going to be arguing for or against this point. We're just going to use this as a way to describe what happened in the breakup of Yugoslavia. Because I think this is actually a pretty similar similar situation. And let me put it this way. Let's say there was a clause in the U.S. Constitution that said that any state in the U.S. can be made its own sovereign nation if it had an agreement among the rest of the U.S. states to do so. And this is super similar to the, you know, the premise of the Yugoslavian constitution that they wrote in 1974, which pretty much said the same thing. It's like, okay, we're all going to be this one big Yugoslavia, but if it doesn't work out, as long as everybody agrees and it's, you know, good for everyone, then you can secede. There's also similar, you know, questions that are happening right now with, you know, Ethiopia, specifically around the Tigray scenario. And I know we talked a lot about that in our episodes on Ethiopia. So let's just pretend for a moment that the U.S. Constitution has a very similar clause. Now, it's no surprise that there is a large population of Mexican Americans that are living in Texas, and particularly in the border communities between Mexico and Texas. Now, let's pretend that Mexico decided that because of racial oppression or something like that, that they wanted to break off and become their own thing. And not like be annexed by Mexico. They wanted to be their own thing. Let's call it, what do we call it last time? New Mexico, right?
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
Right. So we're calling this new sovereign state New Mexico. And so, you know, they make their case, you know, and, you know, obviously a lot like the Bosnians at the time, the Muslim Bosnians, they're not going to get internal support, you know, in the United States to do this. They're probably going to have to, you know, reach out to the international community and make their case there. And, you know, this is highly unlikely, but just pretend like it becomes a thing, right? Because of international pressure, New Mexico is now formed, right? So what would happen in New Mexico is that Mexicans or people of Mexican descent would be a majority in this New Mexico, right? However, there would still be a good number of non-Mexican Americans, you know, non-Mexican American citizens, that is, who live and work and own businesses and everything else in New Mexico. So that could be a little bit of a problem, right? Because an ongoing dispute would pop up about whether or not this New Mexico should be formed. You know, it's possible that, I don't know, maybe Mexico would start supporting the Mexicans and, you know, because they're they share a similar heritage, kind of like how right now Greater Serbia, so Serbia itself, is supporting the Republic of Srpska in Bosnia Herzegovina.
Or why don't we just use the most prevalent and high profile case right now? So Russians supporting separatists in Donbass.
Exactly. You could imagine that could be the case, right? You know, so that would probably cause some tension, because now these, you know, Americans that are living in New Mexico, because that's where their homes are and their businesses are, they just happen to be caught up in the New Mexican Revolution or the New Mexican Secession, right? They might feel a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that now they've become a super minority in what used to be a, you know, where they used to be a majority. Also pretty interesting is that, you know, these Americans living in New Mexico would probably be the heavier armed class, as we know. You know, a lot of Texans own guns and stuff like that. So, you know, it's entirely possible that they'd be willing to fight for what they believe is theirs, or, you know, for their rights and things like that. And they'd be totally within their reason to do so. And now they have a new, you know, threat. And this is like a threat to be oppressed by the former oppressed, right? And this is exactly how the Serbs were feeling, or are feeling, really, in Bosnia and Herzegovina at the time. They're thinking, well, shit, we just got carved out into Bosnia and Herzegovina by international pressure. We didn't want this. This is against our constitution, but it's now a thing. And now we're a minority, and we're afraid that they're going to do fucked up things to us. So, you know, it's very likely that they're going to resist. Now,
hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas. Plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
And all these borders, and I think it's important to note, you know, all these borders are just completely illogical and stupid and not written by the people who live there. It's like, a lot of these states in Eastern Europe and the Balkans and Africa and the Middle East, the people weren't, no one wakes up and draws the borders that they live in. But, I mean, these borders were not drawn to respect the people, the different ethnic groups and stuff like that, you know.
Of course
they're not like islands like a Japan, Japan, like where, you know, you kind of have that island where you can nationalize, and I guess that kind of produces something pretty bad too, and the way Japan was just so fanatically nationalist in the 20th century. But, you know, a really good comparison of, you know, what everyone is following right now, the most prevalent news story is, you know, Ukraine, what's going on in Ukraine. Oh, Russia's going to invade it. And maybe we'll speak about this later in this episode. But,
well, I think more to the point on borders, because I don't want to leave this topic just too quickly.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about Yugoslavia is that, yeah, okay, so I definitely agree with you that they didn't draw these borders for Bosnia and Herzegovina with, like, the ethnic makeup of the people that live there in mind. But you have to understand that, you know, at the time and arguably even still today, like, there is so much intermingling of these ethnic groups and things like that, that it would be impossible to draw a border that makes sense around there. And I think the best example of this would be, you know, an ongoing, arguably one of the ongoing biggest border issues in, you know, the history, in history, is, you know, the Israel-Palestine issue, right? Where you know, we got two groups, you know, Israelis and Palestinians, or Arabs generally, right? And there's a really good mix of both. And so if you look at a place like West Bank, where, you know, from a high level map, it looks like, okay, this is West Bank and that is Israel. If you actually zoom in really good, the real borders of West Bank is Swiss cheese, because they've carved out these little pockets of Israeli settlements within the greater, you know, West Bank. And if you were to try and draw a border in Bosnia and Herzegovina at the time and say, okay, this is going to be the little pockets of Serbs and the little pockets of Croats and the little pockets of Bosnians, the map would make no sense. It would make no sense. And to come back to this hypothetical, the same would be true of New Mexico. Because within New Mexican communities, there's going to be in and around, you know, these American or mostly American non-Mexican communities, there would be Mexican communities, and they'd intermingle, and drawing the border just wouldn't make any sense, right? So it's more than just like, you know, some dude somewhere just decided, hey, this is this is what it's going to be. It'd be worse than our gerrymandering maps, you know? So, you know, it's tough. And so, you know, kind of back to this hypothetical, you know, the creation of this state would run contrary to my initial premise here that the U.S. Constitution had a clause that allowed for secession as long as everyone agreed. Because in this case, I think it's pretty easy to tell nobody's going to agree on this. Nobody's going to agree to making a new New Mexico. And this would obviously run contrary to the U.S.'s ability or capability to self-determine. It would run counter to our sovereignty. And so the grounds on which this new state would be formed could seem reasonable at first, but, you know, with the, you know, I mean, you could say, all right, well, there is a history of, you know, oppression, racially motivated oppression, and that's why these Mexican Americans need their own thing. That could be, you know, on the face of it, could sound reasonable at first. And it's imaginable that the international community might even back it, especially in this hypothetical, right? We're just going to say that they will. And even that international community backing it might seem reasonable by itself. But again, no one in the United States would agree that a new New Mexico state should be formed. And therefore, it would run contrary to the U.S. Constitution. And so furthermore, there's a minority of Americans that are living in this new Mexican state who would either have to leave, which would be literally ethnic cleansing.
It would be ethnic cleansing,
or literally, ethnic cleansing.
It would be forced migration at the very least. And right. I guess ethnic cleansing is, you know, the definition of that is when one group says
uses force, know, right?
Mm-hmm. Uses force to say get out of here, you. We don't want your kind in here. And usually that, you know, is adjacent to some type of horrible atrocity to make, you know, to turn as an example. And then people are mm-hmm. like, okay, let's go. They're serious. They're chopping people's hands off. And, that's like the definition of ethnic cleansing. But, you know, I guess that would be would you consider that voluntary migration if you're forced to stay in a place, but you know that
would you be a second-tier citizen, but maybe there's no threat of violence? Exactly. Well, the thing is, sometimes the perceived threat of violence is enough, right? And it's this is exactly what was going on in Bosnia and Herzegovina on the Serbian side, right? So they believed that, you know, if they're going to be in a country that is majority, you know, Muslim Bosnian, that they would somehow face oppression because they would no longer have, you know, any power in that particular institution, and their fear of the Bosnian Muslims retaliating against what could have been historical, you know, grievances, or even contemporary grievances at the time. You know, it makes sense. Like, if you fucked with somebody enough and then suddenly you're in a position where they're in power over you, yeah, you'd probably have pretty good reason to fear retaliation. And so that retaliation would certainly cause a lot of voluntary migration, right? But is that necessarily voluntary if you have the perceived fear of oppression?
Well, I guess you can make that same argument for, like, economic refugees. I mean, I guess maybe it's not directly relates to oppression, but if you're forced to live in some unfavorable condition, then does that automatically heighten your status as a, you know, some type of refugee that is fleeing an unfavorable situation?
Well, because, in international, you know, law, I think it does account for, you know, economic hardship for sure.
Well, here's the problem why, you know, this is impossible. It's because there's not a single part of the planet that's not covered by a nation state.
Well, there is one. And I think we actually talked about this too.
We did talk about that desert.
Beer to wheel. It's Beer to wheel. It's a small little patch of desert land in between Sudan and Egypt. And I'm not going to go into the entire story behind it because it's complex, but all you need to know is that there's been a border dispute around this one section of just middle of nowhere desert. And, like, legally speaking, if they claim Beer to wheel, they lose claim over another disputed land, which is the Halal Eib Triangle. So nobody really wants to claim it. Neither of these countries want to claim it for that reason. And so it's just kind of no man's land. And what's funny about it is that people will make the very dangerous trek to go to the middle of the desert and go to Beer to wheel, and they'll plant their flag and then name it whatever they want, which is kind of funny. And then until somebody else comes and does the same and conquers that. What would you call your country if you took over Beer to wheel?
Hankistan? I don't know. I don't know. What would I be? Should I be a Stan?
I don't know.
I don't know. Zamota? I can't think of a good. I can't think of a witty one. I'm just gonna go. I'm gonna be a Stan. I'll be Hankistan. Or no, I'll be the Republic. What's that?
I always wanted to run an empire. Yeah, so I'd probably
have
be the
qualify.
The Empire of Abdel Jabaria. You know,
Abdel Jabaria.
Hey, I mean, the word, the name sounds like it would fit in the region, right?
It does. It sounds like one of those countries you'd be like, what the fuck is El Jard? Like, if you put that down on the map. Let me pronounce this. El Jabaria? Yeah.
Abdel Jabaria.
I should know your last name. Abdel Jabaria. Okay. Abdel Jabaria. So if you put that on the map, Abdel Jabaria, then you would be like, what the hell is that? If you, like, wrote an article and you're like, man, the war crimes that are taking place in El Jabaria are heinous.
We're not war criminals, man.
The war crimes that are going on. It sounds like a fictional country that in a Tom Clancy book.
Yeah, totally.
Or it sounds like the name of the game, right?
No, it sounds like the name of a country that they would use in, like, a war game in the U.S. military, you know?
Yeah. It more or less sounds like a, like some type of, like fantasy. Mm-hmm. It would be like a fantasy.
That's what I'm going for. Yeah, that's what I'm going for. You know, like something in Final Fantasy, you know? Oh, it's the Kingdom of Abdel Jabaria.
Zamotistan sounds like some type of vague, like Eastern European country that is like the bad country in some war game or some movie.
Yep.
Oh man, agreed. The terrorists from Zamotistan. Those bastards. I was born in the thought of a family, and now I am mad at the world, and I will be terrorist.
But okay, so to your point, back to your point, because we've went down this rabbit hole, I think, far enough. You know, there is no patch of land where people could just go that isn't already occupied by somewhere else. And so that's why migration, and particularly forced migration or even economic migration, you know, becomes so difficult to deal with. And that's why we're having such a big trouble in, you know, Belarus and Poland's border. You know, well, at the very least, I think that Belarus is, you know, Lukashenko has been proven to have accelerated that issue.
Well, look what happened in France. You know, there is this, you know, tragic event that happened with these migrants who died in the English Channel. I don't know if you read about that story.
I think so.
So I think around 25 or so migrants died in a boat going from an English Channel from France to England. But like my question was, man, is it so shitty in France that you're willing to take a deadly ride?
I don't think necessarily it was like shitty. A little bit in poor taste. I don't think it's shitty on France. I think it's just they thought they had better chances in England. But, you know, even if you – leaving France out of the picture is just thinking about people who are crossing our border here on the south, you know, and they are, you know, legitimately leaving some – at least many of them are leaving really, really bad conditions in their home countries and fear for their lives. And, you know, it makes you think, like, shit, if it's that bad that you would risk your life to leave, you know – you got to stop and think about that. And then kind of bringing it back again to our hypothetical here, you know, these Americans living in New Mexico would, you know, potentially fear for their lives, or at least fear for their livelihood, in a state where they feel that they are now second-class citizens, much in the same way that these Serbians felt at the time when, you know, Bosnia was created. And so... I mean, I think, look, either they have to leave, the Americans living in New Mexico, or, you know, they'd have to stay. And if they stayed, they likely would start receiving U.S. aid, just like, you know, the Mexico would be aiding the Mexicans here. Would that make the U.S. be seen as a aggressor? Like, imagine if the United States says, okay, well, we have to help our American citizens that decided that they want to stay in their homes in New Mexico, and we're going to provide them with, you know, money and guns and you name it so they can protect themselves. Wouldn't that make the U.S. the aggressor in that situation? Wouldn't that make them meddling in the internal affairs of a sovereign state? Not like that's
neutral. Here's the thing. There's no principled precedent that's been set. So in terms of, I guess, where we started this off when we were talking about international law, is secession legal in international law?
Right.
Well, there is no answer to that. No one really knows. It's a case-by-case thing. It's not at all a consistent precedent. And it really just depends on what international player what international player says what, or what an international player is willing to tolerate, and
more pointedly, what the United States says. Because as you point out, there isn't any particular charter in international law that determines that people can secede from any state. Secession is either handled one of two ways. Either A, peacefully by two parties, which is incredibly rare, or B, which is mostly the case, through military aggression, meaning a civil war. And it kind of makes sense that there isn't an international law that would allow for a state to break off from any other state, because if that were the case, then we would constantly see a flux of new countries popping up and splitting and, you know, having civil wars all the time.
I mean, exactly. There'd be no state that would be willing to contain itself.
Or would be able to contain itself. If it was allowed
would not. Yeah, everything would just sliver off and become its own little thing, especially countries that are divided, you know, really, really divided among ethnic lines. Mm-hmm. Like,
like Kurdistan.
Yeah, the U.S., there's racism in the U.S., and there's racism, you know, in every society there is, but you can't really compare it with, like, you know, kind of like the deep-rooted hatreds of peoples, like in other countries, or, you know, the countries like this. unless you're Canada, you know, right? There's no racism at all in Canada.
I don't know, man. Those, you know, they're pretty mean to the Inuits and the native peoples.
I mean, those damn Inuit, those damn Native Canadians. You ever see the South Park making fun of that?
The First Nations.
Bloody I think Native Canadians. For it. What's it? What is that?
I think it's called the First Nations. I think that's the either the politically correct or just straight up the correct term is the First Nations.
Well, so John Dolan, the war nerd, was on Scott Horton the other day, and he was actually talking about Ethiopia. So those are like my two favorite podcasts in the world, the Scott Horton Show and then the Radio War Nerd. And they were talking about the Ethiopian conflict. I know this is a little bit off note, but he was talking about how the context of the conversation was like the ethnic hatred, and then he was talking about Canada. He's like, I was in Canada, and I've never been so shocked. There's multi-ethnic street gangs there. So there'd be an Asian guy, a Russian guy, a white guy. Like, it's like, I've never seen anything like that in my life. Multi-ethnic street gangs.
Multi-ethnic, right.
Like, you know, you're not seeing that in prison. Except in the movie The Warriors. You ever seen The Warriors?
Warriors! Come out and play it! Sorry.
You've seen the Warriors. The gangs there, it was very ahead of its time because all the gangs in the Warriors were like multiracial gangs.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
It's called progress. But it's interesting to think like that. I think Canada and the UK and even the U.S. and a couple of European countries are you know, considered the least racist countries in the world, and then I think the most racist country as far as like opinion polls. I know I'm gonna get shit for saying this, but this is one that most commonly comes up in polls is India.
Yep.
But before I get a bunch of angry emails for saying that.
let's get back to this, because there's still more that, you know, I have to say here.
I know we're getting off track right here. We didn't even get off this track when we recorded this the first time.
I know, right?
We're going further off the rails. But all right, let's. So in the case of international law, so let's look at, because what I just said, that it depends on who you ask. You know, if what a country is willing to tolerate. Another country is willing to tolerate as far as if in a secession movement is going to be accepted or not. So, so the real world examples that are going on right now or that have gone on, you know, in the past 5 years or so, you know, we have Kurdistan or we have Rojava in Syria. The United States is willing to tolerate a Rojava or a Kurdish state in Syria, but Turkey is not willing to tolerate a Kurdish state in northern Syria. So that state doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of countries are willing to tolerate a Rojava, but I think the U.S. would prefer some type of Rojava just to have, you know, be able to squat on oil fields and stuff like that. But Turkey has a vendetta against the Kurds. And I mean, because there's violent Kurdish groups within the Turkish borders. So they're not willing to tolerate that. And then there's the case of Donbass, you know, the one that's really big in the news right now. So, you know, Russia, you know, they're supporting according to Russia, they support some type of secessionist movement. At least they support, you know, autonomy there or kind of work on behalf of them. But, you know, the Ukrainian government and NATO and you know, the Western world is not really willing to tolerate that. Especially in the case of Crimea as well, where people are, I guess that's not a secession, that's more of an annexation, but the people voted to be part of Russia in Crimea. And then there's Tigray, you know, where there's a country that is kind of falling apart on ethnic lines based on how, you know, the borders were drawn and how it was set up. It seems like the U.S. is more willing to tolerate some type of secession movement, but, you know, I'm not exactly sure how that's going to play out in the future. But it's just really based on what the United States really says, or at least the closest nearest power. It seems like Turkey has a lot of pull on world affairs when it comes to at least what's going on in their regional world, because you know, they'll do things that are directly, they're NATO, but they don't act like along with other NATO.
They don't act like NATO.
Country. They don't. They sure as hell don't act like NATO. They just kind of do their own thing, and they do their own interest. It's kind of interesting to see them do things that are not.
See how that works out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
well, I mean, look. I mean, in the case of Rojava, right? Like, or a Kurdistan, whatever we want to call it. You know, at least part of that might constitute, you know, territories inside of Turkey, and Turkey wouldn't have it for sure. So, you know, look, the U.S. and the international community, back when Bosnia was created, we backed Bosnia's right to exist as its own independent state. And, you know, therefore, I think based on all of the things that we've been talking about here, I think you could label this as an illegal intervention into the self-determination of the Yugoslavian state. Because of the aforementioned, you know, they have their own set of laws. They're their own country. Like, who is anyone else to say who can and can't leave? And I'm not trying to make the argument here that Serbians did nothing wrong. And I'm also not trying to make the argument that the Bosnian Muslims would not have been oppressed by the Serbian, you know, majorities. I'm also not saying that the Bosnian Muslims in Bosnia wouldn't have oppressed the Serbian minorities in Bosnia. All I'm trying to say is we got to look at this from like the legal standpoint of national sovereignty, you know, because after all, what is sovereignty if it can be undone by an international community? And so it really makes you think about why the international community decided that it wanted to illegally intervene in the Yugoslavian state. And there's honestly a lot of flip-flopping that goes on around this. So listen to this. In the summer of 1991, the U.S. favored the preservation of Yugoslavia. So meaning they didn't want it to break up. And pretty much immediately thereafter, just a couple months later in the spring of 92, they said, no, we should break that up and there should be a Bosnia. And then after that Bosnian breakup, they were like, okay, no, territorial integrity means a lot, so we shouldn't break up Bosnia or any other country now because, you know, I don't know, borders are sacred and something, something, new world order, right? And literally, this is a span over like, I don't know, 18 months total. So we were the ones who egged it on, and then we went back on it, and then we back and forth and over again. And really, the linchpin here that no one really talks about for this is that the Soviet Union collapsed. And, you know, we initially wanted to keep Yugoslavia together because they were useful for us when the Soviet Union was around. They were a buffer zone against the Soviet states. But now that the Soviet Union wasn't anymore, we really didn't have a need for them, Yugoslavia that is, to be one single entity. And therefore, we start becoming cool with them breaking up.
Well, so there's, yeah, so you pointed out there's this huge policy shift. And, you know, we were talking about this last week, and when we did our episode on Yugoslavia, you were like, mm-hmm. you know, why do you think that there was this shift? Like, why did the U.S. favor Balkanization of Yugoslavia right. after the fall of the Soviet Union? And I don't think most people who do this, you know, full time for a living, can really have great answers regarding what was the main motivation for the Clinton administration and their intervention in breaking up Yugoslavia into these territories and doing what they did, and you know, oops, I just dropped my microphone. Let me get this. So let's just go back to Yugoslavia when it starts to unravel in the early 1990s, because I think it's important to point out that U.S. leaders, they were looking at it with benign detachment, you know, especially when like Slovenia and Croatia and Bosnia were all declaring their independence. and they exited the Federation. Like, they were just like, okay, that's fine, that's good, like, great, because Yugoslavia prior was, you know, it was a communist country. However, Yugoslavia was a they weren't like a Soviet satellite. They weren't, you know, part of the Iron Curtain. You know, they were independent. They had some level of privatization in their economy with major industries and farmland and agriculture. So they weren't, you know, completely full blown, you know, Soviet sycophants. Tito had kicked out the Comintern after the war. They had their disagreements. So they were kind of like this weird second world country or something. Like, they kind of were like that example of like a second world state. If you want to call it that, you know, they obviously had some problems that comes with, you know, with centralized planning and pricing and stuff, but, you know, they did make some type of changes, and, you know, they were taking IMF loans prior to the breakup, right?
That's right.
I'm pretty sure you brought that up.
Yep, that's right. So they, you know, they, Yugoslavia was super interesting because they were communist, but like not exactly. I guess kind of like China now, before China became China. They obviously maintained a socialist country, and they were communist in governance, but they started opening up to international funds because it was beneficial to them, but also just because they needed it at a certain juncture. And there was a lot of prosperity that was happening at the time. And I think I went over this in the last episode, but, you know, I can bring up a couple of easy points. As an example, they had super high growth rate between 1960 and 1980. They had a decent standard of living, for what it's worth. Medical care, education were all free, guaranteed jobs, 1 month paid vacation, super high literacy rate. Apparently they were over 90%, and their life expectancy was about 72 years old, which was fairly high. And this all happened in not a capitalist society. It happened where most of the economy was in the public and not in the not-for-profit sector. And that ran totally contrary to global capitalism. But somehow the IMF managed to convince the Yugoslavians that, hey, you should take some money for us and it'll make your lives easier and better. And, you know, I think when it comes to why Yugoslavia broke up or why we were so interested in that, I think it's a combination of a bunch of things, but part of it is that they no longer served a purpose for us as a buffer state to the Soviets, since the Soviets weren't a thing anymore. And part of it was just that we already started doing business with them, and it's easier to, let's say, take advantage of smaller, more disparate states than it would one cohesive, unified one that, you know, for all intents and purposes, was doing pretty well for itself as it was. And I really think that that part of this is, for me, very, very compelling. You know, following that money trail.
So, I mean, all right. I think that's definitely the Occam's razor, right there. I think that's probably the reason. I agree with you on that.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. You'll hear advice on everything from how to build confidence to how to get the best night's sleep. New episodes drop every weekday, and each one is 5 minutes or less, so you only have to listen a little to get a lot more out of your weekdays. Listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
More so than, I guess, do you want to jump into what we were reading, what I read to you last week? Because I feel like this is a pretty good segue.
Yeah.
So I was pulling up some Justin Raimondo, and Justin Raimondo, he wrote a lot. So antiwar.com, you know, Justin Raimondo was one of the founders of antiwar.com, you know, one of the great muckrakers of all time. He died 2 years ago. But he's a very sardonic, or he was a very sardonic writer, very tongue-in-cheek a little bit, I would say aggressive in his writing, wrote vicious hit pieces about people. He was a prick, but he was a great muckraker. So, and he's probably my favorite writer of all time. I love everything that he writes. Now, his reason for, you know, what he wrote in his famous pamphlet, it's called Inside the Bosnian Quagmire. He blames it on on liberal internationalism, like the ideology of liberal internationalism. So just to kind of just go over the history, though, first is that George Bush, you know, he seemed inclined to let Europe deal with the conflict, and mm-hmm. Europe was able to iron out some deals like the Vance Owen plan. And, you know, when I say Europe, I mean like Britain, France, and Germany, and the EU.
Right.
But, you know, the Clinton administration, when they got into power, they really, stepped up involvement. And, you know, they took the lead on the policy. And, you know, their policies were very, they had anti-Serb measures in place. And, you know, it was them that decided to use military force in NATO. And, you know, that ultimately led to NATO launching airstrikes against Bosnian Serb forces. Now, I'm going to read this out to you. So Justin Raimondo wrote, "With communism dead and all but buried, their allegiance has shifted from socialist internationalism of the woozy Wilsonian variety. The Clinton administration is the perfect vessel of new Wilsonian internationalism in seeking an explanation for the incredible political risk undertaken by an administration not known for its principled stands. No commentator seems to have come up with a coherent theory as to what motivated the president to do what he said he would never do, put American ground forces in the Balkans. If we look at the details of the Dayton Accord, however, there is in it its convoluted and detailed provisions a certain logic. For it is not an agreement to silence the guns, but a blueprint for the Bosnian body politic. Embedded in its complex clauses is a single-minded and even fanatical devotion to the concept of a Bosnia as a model of multi-ethnic diversity." So, well, before we get into that, I just want to explain what the Dayton Peace Accords were. We spoke about the Dayton Accords briefly last week. So the Dayton Accords is what ended the war in 1995, or the peace accords that kind of set the current Bosnian government in place. So it split the country into two administrative entities, a Serb-run entity, a Republika Srpska, and then a Bosnian Croat-dominated federation entity. And, you know, the post-war agreement turned Bosnia basically into a pretend country, I guess. I mean, is that just too flagrant to call them a pretend country? They're not really.
What country is not a pretend country at this point?
They're yeah, well, I mean, this is to a very high level. So Bosnia is completely dependent on international financial inputs. You know, the ethnic divisions are still exist. They make political cooperation pretty much impossible. You know, right now, you know, the country is just completely poverty stricken. It's dysfunctional, and it's 100% dependent on the international community. And you know, despite that, it has a status as an independent state, but the real power resides in like international officials. So, you know, when NATO turned over responsibility for post-war reconstruction to the UN after the Dayton Accords, the UN appointed a high representative, and high representative, it's their job was to resolve policy disputes by fiat if contending parties couldn't reach an agreement. So there's a high representative who can just dictate major policy decisions there, who's not
such a ridiculous
elected. It's just a UN. It's just a UN. So it's just some German guy named Christian Schmidt. He's the UN administrator in Bosnia. And, you know, the high administrator, they decree, you know, like a Roman consulate who's dictating terms to the Gauls. You know, they're basically a colony. They're viceroys.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really, it's just like,
well, I mean,
what
it,
the fuck?
It, first of all, the name is so stupid, right? It's just like, look at me.
I am your German high representative.
Okay, that's the first one. The second one that really jumps out at me is the fact that they impose those decisions that they make and resolve those policy disputes by fiat, as you say. So, in other words, by giving or withholding money. So again, this just reinforces what my opinion. This Bosnia wasn't created in good faith that we're gonna. You know, as Justin Raimondo said, I think it, at least it's part of it, right? That might be like the superficial tip of the iceberg where we wanted to, you know, play in the sandbox and make, you know, a multi-ethnic country in the middle of, you know, Southeast Europe. Maybe that's a little bit about it. But really, really, when you look at how the structure is set up, where a high representative is basically the end-all be-all, and the way that they dictate their power is through money. It's very clear to me that it was just easier to control that region. It's easier to you know, plunder that region if they break it up and set up a system by which they can overrule that new thing's sovereignty. Because that's what
it's easier to boss. It's easier to boss around small, weak states than a big, strong state.
That's
like,
right.
Why do you think the U.S. was so bent on keeping the Arab nations from uniting? You know, because there was, you know, a movement to pretty much unite all the Arab countries and, you know, have kind of like a socialist type economy where they share the oil wealth, and the United States didn't want that to happen. But, you know, Syria and Egypt combined for 2 years, but it didn't really work out. It actually was horrible. I mean, it was just the same problems that you would expect in, like, an ethnic world. Well, all right, let me not get too ahead of myself. I'll just say that Nasser was very unfair to the Syrians when they combined, and it just caused a lot of problems. But that's a subject to another – that's another subject. Let me get back to this Raimondo thing, because I just think it's—I think this is just a funny article or a funny pamphlet, and it definitely can match somebody's worldview. And I'm kind of convinced that I know you probably wouldn't as much. So the plan. He's writing about the Dayton Accords. The plan drafted by the U.S. State Department divides Bosnia into two sub-entities. the Serbian region, and the Croatian Muslim Federation. The country will therefore have multiple presidents, and not only that, it will also have multiple armies and presumably government officials in triplicate feeding at the public through. This plan truly has Bill Clinton's stamp all over it, in parentheses. These parallel structures are supposed to lead to a permanent peace between factions that have been battling for 400 years. I mean, he's being facetious right there. I don't think they've been battling for 400 years. Instead, this schizoid state can only last as long as the U.S.-NATO troops are there to prop it up. The whole constitutional structure of the Bosnian state, as envisioned by Richard Holbrook and company, is like an intricate and very expensive machine designed to perform only one function, to break down. In a classic case of psychopolitical projection, the Dayton Accord imposes on the signatories a system apparently modeled on the modern American campus where each ethno-religious minority has its own ethnic studies department, its own dormitories, and its own campus organizations. In the imaginary state of Bosnia, its American architects have erected a model of multiculturalism, an edifice perfectly suited to the fragmented and inherently contentious structure of Bosnian civil society. Bosnia's collective presidency is an attempt to replicate the relative calm of the immediate post-Tito era, when the Communist Party of Yugoslavia adopted a similar system. Indeed, the provisions of the Dayton Accord detailing the constitutional structure of the Bosnian state are merely a more elaborate variation on the old Yugo-communist system. The question that every thinking American must be asking at this point is, why must Serbs and Croats be forced to live under Bosnian Susantry? The answer is that that Clinton's crusade for multi-ethnicity abroad is but a projection of the liberal domestic agenda, racial victimology, affirmative action, and a wholesale assault on property rights in the name of multiculturalism. In the hierarchy of victim groups, the Bosnian Muslims have acquired international celebrity status, not since Hollywood discovered the inherent nobility of the Native American has a victim group's misfortune been the focus of so much media attention. The American left of the 90s, for whom victimology and the group and group rights has replaced Marxist socialism as an animating ideology, has been well prepared to accept and enthusiastically endorse interventionism and militarism in the name of political correctness. Under the pressure of the events in the former Yugoslavia, the loony internationalism of the liberal elite has overwhelmed the traditional anti-war proclivities of the left. So someone who, I don't know, do you still consider yourself part of the left?
No. I'm certainly not in the right.
I don't consider myself part of the right anymore. But
yeah.
I feel like I used to be part of the right, and I feel like you used to be part of the left.
Yeah, I feel like there's a Z-axis that we don't talk about. You know what I mean? Like, there's like left, right, there's authoritarian and libertarian, right? So there's that square, right? That's, you know, two dimensions. There's a Z-axis that I quite haven't figured out yet, and I'm on that Z-axis instead. You know, kind of moving away from the square.
I'm pretty much the same way. I like how Dan Carlin says it. He calls himself a political Martian. I feel like that's a good way to put it. I don't really fall in the camps, but this is, I think, is funny, and I think there's definitely some truth to it. I think that there is this this attitude in like academia and among like, you know, liberal elite society that does have this mentality when it comes to international affairs, like the liberal internationalist. They do use, maybe this isn't the main modifier. Like, I don't think this is like what I don't think this is what motivates people, you know, countries to interfere, but I think this is how you can justify it, you know, to yourself.
Yeah.
I think this is how you can justify it to yourself. I mean, I don't think that this was purely just a project to create multiculturalism in a foreign country, but I think you can tell yourself that after, you know, you chop up the country and then you kind of drain its resources, like you.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be a nefarious way to spin it. Be like, oh, we're gonna chop up the country and like, you know, rape them financially, but we're gonna play it like we're making an ethnic, multi-ethnic, like wonder state, and look at us,
yeah,
awesome. You know, like that's it. Could be the nefarious way. It could just, or it could be the other way around. It could be, you know, there were people who legitimately wanted to have a glorious multi-ethnic state in Bosnia and Herzegovina where people didn't fight and they got along and stuff like that, and that was all true and good intentioned, but they were used as useful idiots by the folks that actually just wanted to chop up the country and make it easier for them to boss it around.
You know, it's kind of funny because our current conflict, Ukraine, if you kind of compare it to that, it's not... Like, there's so many things that are just completely at odds with, like, the modern liberal values. Like, I'm not talking about, like, liberal as in, like, classical liberal. You know, like, the liberal Democrat values, liberal left values, liberal center left values. I guess there's so many ways to explain it. But, you know, like, whatever Joy Reid is, or, you know, whatever she is, or whatever Rachel Maddow is. Whatever those characters are, there's, you know, this, I can definitely see this being like, oh, we need to protect, you know, the poor people of this country. But then that same group of people are for supporting, like, you know, fascist types in Ukraine. So it's like those values are directly thrown a loop and they shift depending on the international scenario, and I don't really think it has anything to do with really caring about the people there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'll say. I guess I'm not sure if I said that in a well-spoken manner, but I don't think that really any or most geopolitical decisions to intervene in the country have to do with like pet projects in some weird academic's head. I think they mostly have to do with just like money. Fucking money is what really motivates people.
It's always money.
But I guess the greater, I just think that's an interesting read, and you know, at least, you know, I really just don't have like a good grasp or a good conclusion on why the U.S. intervened. But, you know, the Occam's razor approach, I think, may be the way to go. But I think the biggest conclusion that I've taken from this, from the U.S. Intervention in Bosnia, is that, you know, it was just kind of a big missed opportunity for the U.S. to set more rational priorities for itself in the post-Cold War world. And, you know, by taking that leadership role, what Washington ultimately does, it reinforces this unhealthy European dependence on U.S. security guarantees. And, you know, right now this is still a controversy that's in, I guess it's not really talked about too much anymore since Trump has been gone. But, you know, one of the things that Trump ran on was you know, NATO, not NATO burden sharing. Mm-hmm. So it's still something in the political sphere. I guess that conversation doesn't really show up. I don't, you know, other Republicans don't really even talk about that, besides Trump. But you know, the end product of the U.S. intervention is created this kind of festering political and economic mess, and you know, no one really wants to take responsibility of, you know, the overwhelming evidence that this nation building venture was a complete failure. And, you know, I've been trying to kind of somehow fit the current crisis in Ukraine in this entire episode because it's just so relevant right now, but I don't want to get too off track. And I guess we have a couple of minutes, or we have a little bit to talk. Have you been following, do you mind if we move on or
yeah,
talk about
fine.
This briefly?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. So have you been following this? I know you've been real busy moving right now, and I've been busy too, but have you been paying attention to the Slack conversations in our Patreon group about this?
I've been seeing them, but I haven't been reading any of the
I haven't been reading any of the articles that have been going on. So why don't you fill me in? Tell me what the fuck is going on, and I'll give you my genuine reaction.
So, I mean, it's pretty cyclical. So, you know, the media... So, basically, you know, we had this conversation about in April about the fear that Russia was going to invade Ukraine. And, you know, we looked at where the Russian troops were stationed, and they're hundreds of miles away. And the way that the media is reporting it is that if there's... you know, Russian tanks and Russian MiGs flying across the border, and they're just, you know, peering into the frontier or the borderland, and they're ready to just march on down to Kiev and kill everyone that they run into. So the way that it's being reported is that these satellite pictures are being kind of circulated about across every single news outlet is ran with the story. I mean, like Politico had a story on this, New York Times already on this, Yahoo News had a story on this, Bloomberg had a story on this, Wall Street Journal had a story on this, and they're sharing this satellite imagery of like these Russian troop buildups, and then you like look at them and you're like, okay, where are these Russian troops build up from based on these satellite images? And, you know, they're hundreds of miles away. If you just, like, type in, okay, they're in this city or this province, like, that's kind of far. So the way that it's being spun is that Russia is about to go and conquer Ukraine right now. And that's what's eventually led to this conference between Biden and Russia where, you know, I just watched the Jake Sullivan being interviewed about it by the press. And he was saying that he basically said that the U.S. will not be intervening in so many words.
Like, okay.
He basically said it because Blinken said that the commitment to Ukraine, I think he used the word ironclad. And I think he used the word ironclad in the case of Taiwan as well. But what Sullivan said was that. You know, the Biden administration is basically not considering direct military intervention in the event of a Ukraine invasion. And the reason why I know he said that is because he kept on saying that we've told them that there would be severe economic penalties if there was an invasion, but not, he didn't say anything militarily. And then the press is there, like, kind of baiting Sullivan. And, you know, I thought Sullivan came off looking reasonable compared to, like, the animals in the press. And, you know, the press were just
why
like,
not
oh,
kill him?
Rah, 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 rah. And I was like, holy shit, these people are just warmongering monsters. These people who work on, like, the corporate press. Just like, how can we let this go on? Rah, rah. Well, and, you know, Biden, I think that, and, you know, I dislike Biden a lot, by the way, so... This is not coming from the defender of the liberal left at all. But Biden, I don't think, wants anything to do with like a conflict. Like, he does not want to get bogged down in a conflict with Russia right now in Ukraine. He certainly does. It seems like that would just, it's a lose-lose situation for him politically right now to get bogged down in a crisis there, because it seems like both major political parties, well, obviously most, that goes without saying that both major political parties want escalation to rack it up. So, you know, Republicans have now turned into like the new Russia Gators. Oh, Biden's weak on Russia. Let's go, Brandon. It's just so stupid. It's just so dumb. But what I think, you know, what the conspiratorial part of me says is that this is all just because what Ukraine's asking is for a permanent military presence from American soldiers. And I think that here's my conspiratorial side. They want to like have they want to just take out the rest of the separatists in Russia. and not in Russia, in Donbass, in eastern Ukraine, because you know Ukraine and we're dealing with another ethnic conflict right now. Ukraine's basically two nations right now. There's a Ukrainian-speaking part in the west, and there's the Russian part in the east. And you know the parts of the Russian part have in a specific region called the Donbass region of. You know, they're aiming for a separatist, or you know, they're against the Ukrainian government that they see as too Ukrainian nationalist for them, and they feel like they're going to be oppressed. And you know, that's why the Crimean there was a vote in Crimea to be part of Russia after there was the famous coup in 2014. They thought that was too far. So I guess the point I'm trying to get is that maybe they want American troops there because they want to just like fire, like they want to go after these separatists, and they fear that there could be a Russian response if they go go and try to, you know, make a final attack on the separatist. And if there's American tripwire there, that would prevent Russia from, you know, engaging with them militarily because out of fear of killing an American soldier. That's kind of like what...
Right, but isn't the tripwire gone, though?
Well, the tripwire would be for Russia, for having American soldiers in, you know, embedded with Ukrainian troops would be tripwire because Russia wouldn't be able to
militarily. Maybe I missed this part. Maybe I missed this part. Are you suggesting that the plan is for us to do that, to embed our troops there? And if that's the case, how does that constitute?
That's what the Ukrainian government is asking from the United States.
I see. But as you pointed out, Sullivan said that we're not going to get involved. So the likelihood that we do that is
he said that in so many words, he said that they're not, that it's going to be purely economic, that he was saying like, you know, we're 100% committed to the Ukrainian sovereignty and all this, and but I think I haven't watched like right wing news yet today, which I think I'm going to watch it after this. I'm just curious to see what they say. I know Tucker Carlson will be fine on it, but I'm going to listen to Sean Hannity and see what he says.
Just to have him lose his mind about it.
Because I'm sure that when I turn, I want to look at what Sean Hannity says and what they're saying on Fox News. And I've noticed that Newsmax, which is supposed to be the populist right news channel, they have been really, really hard attacking Biden from the liberal left on Ukraine. It's weird. Mm-hmm. Like all the political... foreign policy positions have been shifting, and it's just like they're so unprincipled that it's almost laughable at this point. Like,
so they're basically saying that we should be engaging militarily.
So basically, like, mainstream Republicans right now sound like Democrats did 2 years ago. Like, that's what they sound like when they talk about Russia. They sound silly and stupid, but it's partisan politics, and partisan politics makes everything stupider and dumber.
Right. So whatever your opponent says, you have to say the opposite, just out of principle.
Yeah, and both the Republican and Democratic parties are
centralized.
No, I'm not, but they're both just beholden to the military industrial complex and their donors and stuff. So, you know, you can't really expect principled arguments or principled stances on really anything. It's all just partisan politics and getting victories where you can. But yeah, that's the state of U.S. politics right now. But hey, at least there's not a deadly secession movement where people are getting killed, right?
Yeah, at least.
Not yet.
No, man. I mean, I think this is the correct move, you know, much in the same way that I give Trump the, you know, positive points for not blowing up Iran after, you know, the situations that happened there. You got to give Biden some points too for being like, nope, we're not going to get involved. You know, I think that's probably a good idea. I fear for the Ukrainians, but they're going to have to figure it out.
Well, the thing that just annoys me so much is that everyone's saying this like invasion is so so imminent that Russia is going to invade Ukraine any second now. And I'm like, man, have you looked at polling data in Russia? The Russian public doesn't want that.
Right. The Russian public doesn't have any say in it. It's what does the Russian government, or more specifically,
there needs to be some level of popular. So Putin has like a popular. I think he has an approval rate of like 60% right now.
Yeah, but isn't he outgoing soon?
The government still wants to have a certain level of popularity. Like it would be extremely unpopular to get into like a ground war in Ukraine. All the major problems that they're facing right, like Russia has a lot of problems economically right now. They can't afford to go into and get bogged down into some military conflict in Ukraine, especially when that's the entire world will be against them. Like they really just can't afford to do that. I mean, Russia is a country with like, I mean, how many time zones? Like every time zone, or like 11 time zones or something like that.
All the time zones on that side of the world, they have it.
They'd be able to launch a bunch of missiles and obliterate Ukrainian forces, and it would be really bad for Ukraine. But I mean, they'd just be bogged down. It'd be terrible. And you know, the U.S. and would fund any type of resistance movement against them. So it would just be. Putin's not stupid enough to do that. What Putin is doing in Donbass is that since, and this goes back to NATO, when NATO became offensive instead of defensive, so NATO's expansion, you know, the war in Yugoslavia the wars of Yugoslavia, you know, the wars in the 90s, gave NATO a reason to exist, and it turned NATO into an offensive organization rather than a defensive organization. And NATO continued to expand its borders, and that is what is that's the main reason for this conflict, is NATO expansion, because now Russia does meddle in Ukraine, and Russia is not a good actor at all. They do want chaos in Ukraine, but the reason why is they don't want a solid nation state in Ukraine, because a solid nation state would more likely get membership to NATO. So Ukraine can't get Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, he keeps on lying and says, like, you know, all the paperwork is filled out in just a matter of days that we're going to get approved to be in NATO. But it's like he's making that up. It's not. Ukraine doesn't, like, have any of the requirements to be part of NATO. One of them being is that you can't have, like, pre-existing border disputes and stuff like that and join. So they're not even really eligible. They wouldn't bring anything to the table because they don't really have a military. They had to rely on, you know, kind of fascist, super hard right groups to be kind of like their shock troops in like the early years of the current war. So, and you know, I'm not saying at all that Ukraine is dominated or there's like a huge portion of like, you know, neo-Nazi types in Ukraine. But they certainly have a pretty strong influence there, especially with the security apparatus there. So it's in Russia's interest to have a kind of fragmented Ukraine, a bittering Ukraine, a fighting Ukraine, because then it would be less likely for NATO to be able to expand its borders there. So that's why. I think that's kind of the root of the conflict right now. And it sucks. I mean, I think it's awful, man. Ukrainian politicians are pretty bad. Now Zelensky's approval rating is like 20% because he didn't keep any of the promises that he said he was. And, you know, this also could be, you know, you see pictures of Sean Penn walking around with the troops there. I guess he's making a documentary or something, but they just look so stupid. And it's like, all these articles will show like Ukrainian soldiers in like these trenches right now. It's like, get on the front lines. They're basically reporting that there's a war against Russia right now with Ukrainian troops. And I'm like, nope. Is that actually happening? It's like, nope, we're just reporting it. Like, there's actually like a firefight going on between Russian and Ukrainian soldiers. No, there isn't, but we're reporting it.
We're reporting something that isn't happening.
But Sean Penn's here, and he has a helmet, and he is making a movie. Hopefully he doesn't make a movie about, like, you know, to, you know, some of the far extreme elements there, because that would be bad for his reputation. Okay. Do you have anything else to say? Or because I'm rambling so much, and I don't know if I'm making any more sense.
No, man. I think this is a good ending point.
Okay. After two times recording this episode, one of which you'll hear, I hope this is the better one out of the two. But both were very different. Both were actually extremely. Both were very different. So I guess hopefully this was the better of the two. But thanks for joining us for another episode of Bro History. Once again, you know, we're sorry for the delay in episodes. You know, kind of a freak thing that happened with the audio. We are going to continue to try our hardest to get episodes out. We're still both doing a lot of traveling. Danny, of course, is in, you know, wherever the hell he is right now in Puerto Rico, doing a podcast in Airbnbs on a cardboard box. So, you know, come on, A for effort for Danny. and then, so once we get settled down, the episodes will be back to weekly episodes and it'll be a lot more consistent. So just bear with us. Whenever we have time to record, we're going to record something and plan an episode. So we're going to try our hardest to get them out. In the meantime, rate and review the podcast. If you want to support our show, you can also join us on Patreon, where you can join our Slack account, where we have really awesome conversations, and you know, we have some awesome people in there who are really smart. Who we have some awesome people on Ukraine and Russia in there as well, who have a lot of great insight. So join our Patreon and support us, and we will see you guys soon.
Peace.
Peace.